The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to today's show. This is the Retirement and IRA Show. My name is Chris Stein. I'll be joined here momentarily with Jim Salnier. Jim had to step out of the studio for just a moment. He printed something on the printer and had forgotten it. On today's show, we are actually live broadcasting over the internet. It is just after 3:30 p.m. on October 30th, 2017, as we record this live. This will be made available as a podcast. A little bit later this week, I think those get posted up every Saturday, so you'll be able to listen to it. As far as I know, right now as we speak, there's no listeners, but I'd heard there's a few people that are interested in calling in to ask their live questions on the show here. We do have, I believe, an estate planning question that's going to be handled by one of our resident estate planning attorneys that help us out. Brandon Raines, I believe, is going to join us a little bit later. He's with a client right now, but he's going to call into the show when he gets free, and we'll cover that email question at that time. We have a couple of other email questions, and actually, Jim, I just realized you didn't tell me the topics of those other email questions.
I was trying to figure them out.
Oh.
Apparently, I have that one.
Estate planning question, special needs trust issue.
We have an estate planning question, a special needs trust question, mm-hmm. and a question on your favorite topic, I just found out, net unrealized appreciation.
Oh.
Which you disparage.
Yeah, hot topic. I don't disparage it. It's just other than
saying
it's boring.
You said boring.
It is a little boring.
It's actually not that boring if you know how it works.
No, I think the more you know how it works, the more boring it gets. It sounds exciting. NUA. What's that? Oh, yeah, it's just we have to have a special
rule
for
when you do it wrong.
When we have employer,
you can screw it
stock
up.
In our IRA. So,
but that's what we hope to do. I've got the three questions right here in front of me.
Well, we do now have a couple of live listeners.
Well, good.
So if you're listening live and have a live question, the call-ins to the show always get priority over our email questions that we answer. The phone number to call in live if you are listening live here on October 30th, 2017 at 3:36 Mountain Time. The phone number to call would be 970-530-0556. That number is 970-530-0556. You'll be connected to Laura here in the office, and she'll take your name and information and let us know that you're on the line, and we'll jump to you very quickly.
Those two listeners could be Laura and Andrew.
It could be. So we
don't get overly excited.
No, I know. I'll put it out there. So,
but to our iTunians, if you can remember, Monday afternoons, 3:30 Mountain Time, which could be, of course, 5:30 Eastern Time. What else are you going to be doing 5:30 Eastern Time? But
driving home, eating dinner.
Streaming the Retirement and IRA show off the
early
internet.
Especially back east, that's early to eat dinner, I've found.
I usually eat around 6.
Yeah, even when you were at home in Boston?
Yeah.
Everybody I know from the East Coast eats late, like 8 or something.
No, we never did. And then, we never did.
Because the news isn't even on until like 11.
Yeah, the news, it's really screwy. I'm so used to everything being on earlier, and then I go home and I have to wait till 11 o'clock for the news.
Yeah.
And you're watching Monday Night Football and the games are still on at 1 in the morning.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
I'm just
not used to any of that anymore being here on Mountain Time. But every Monday afternoon, 3:30 Mountain Time, we're going to broadcast the show. We record it anyways for our iTunians. So we figured if we were recording it, we might as well broadcast it live. The intent, people can listen, and instead of sending emails, I have 3 emails here, one from 02... God, none of them have said where they're from. Oh, one's Connecticut. Not quite sure. Do we have Connecticut?
We have Connecticut.
We have Connecticut. So. Mm-hmm. The other one is North Carolina.
We're still looking for Delaware. Delaware is still our last holdout on the eastern seaboard.
I think we might have received one last week. We're not going to get to it this
from
week.
From Delaware?
I think so. Don't get too excited.
Oh, wow. You're making me a little excited. We've been begging for Delaware for months.
That one's buried somewhere deep in my iPad. I haven't printed it out yet. But we'll get to these 3 email questions. Also, if we have the time, we'll give a little update from the Ed Slot group. I will have to say before we start, without doubt, because I just came back from the Ed Slot group last week.
We were in Kansas City.
Kansas City, Missouri. And without doubt, I met a gentleman from Georgia who has the best break the ice name story I have ever heard in my life.
What? What's a break the ice name story?
When you find out his name, it leads to a whole story. You know, break the ice. It was a good... He was sitting at our table at breakfast time. I can't say our table. I went through the breakfast line and I went to a table and I sat down and introduced myself. And one thing led to another, and this gentleman has the best. Without it, I mean, everybody at the table was in awe of his story. So I'm going to share that story. I'm not going to use the gentleman's real name.
Is this a story that will keep our iTunian listeners happy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I sat down, and we're all wearing name tags at the Ed Slot group. And your name tag is either going to be in green to indicate someone who's been there a while or yellow to indicate someone new. And other than that, everybody has a name tag. And it just says your first name, where you're from. That's all it says. So I sat down and across the table, it's a round table, and the far end at the other side of the table is a rather large man. He was a large man sitting there, and I smiled at him and I said, good morning, and I could read his name tags. I had my glasses on. And his name was Cosmo.
In yellow or green?
Green. So I looked at him and I said, morning, Cosmo. And he said, good morning. And I just said to him, I says, you know, I can't help but think of Seinfeld when I see your name, Cosmo. And for those who don't know, Seinfeld character named Kramer, turns out that his first name was Cosmo. Cosmo Kramer. And he looked at me and he said, Cosmo Kramer, in a very southern drawled accent, is named after me. And I looked at him and I said, He says, that's right. True story. Cosmo Kramer is named after me. Well, you need to know that story.
Well, true. You can't just leave it at that.
No, if Cosmo Kramer is named after this Cosmo. And I asked him, how did Cosmo Kramer get named after you? And he went on to tell me the story. And he said, it's not his real name, because I thought Cosmo was the guy's real name. He said, Cosmo is not my real name. Now, I don't want to give the guy's real name, but he had a very southern-sounding name. It was a four-part name. The last part was the fourth.
Like, right.
Buford T. Justice the Fourth. Now, that wasn't his name. I don't want to give his real name. But it was a definite Southern-sounded name. Mm-hmm. So he tells us all at the table his name in a very Southern-drawled accent. My name is Buford T. Justice the Fourth. And he said that he was in high school, as he put it, on the football team in the 70s. And back then, he had a very strong interest in technology. Hmm. And he said, technology back then isn't like we have it today, he said. But one of my friends on the football team's clock broke, and it was an electronic clock. And he said, I fixed it. So at practice, the friend is telling the other members of the team that Buford T. Justice the Fourth fixed his clock. Well, the coach gets involved. And I don't know if that upset the coach that they're talking more about the clock than practicing football. So the coach anointed Buford T. Justice the Fourth with the name Cosmo. And he said, in the 1970s, if you were a high school football player and the coach gave you a name, that name stuck, he said. So he said, that's how he got the name Cosmo. Well, his uncle was actually lived not in Georgia, lived in California, and was actually friends with, Louise Dreyfus, what's her name? Elaine?
Julia Louise
Dreyfus. Mm-hmm. Was friends with her. And he said, my uncle has since died, so I can't delve into this story any more than what he told me. But he said, one day I'm at home and my uncle called me. And he said to me, Julia Louise Dreyfus just called me and told me to tell you to watch Seinfeld tonight. And his uncle went on to relate to him a story that 3 or 4 months earlier, he was out with her, with Julia Maria, whatever her name is, Elaine. He was out with Elaine, and they were talking, and Cosmo came up in conversation, that the uncle just said, my nephew Cosmo, and Cosmo couldn't remember how his uncle shared with him, the name came up, and Elaine said to the uncle, excuse me? Cosmo? And the uncle says, yeah, his nickname is Cosmo. He's my nephew. And he didn't pay any attention to it. So he watched Seinfeld that night. And of course, it was the night that Kramer's name came out. And it was Cosmo Kramer. Now, of course, there's no proof that did Elaine get the script that week and see that Kramer is going to be called Cosmo, and she remembered the uncle said his nephew's name was Cosmo, so she was just calling him and say, hey, your nephew's going to get a kick out of this, watch Seinfeld? Or did Elaine have any input with the writers? Because it wasn't Elaine naming Kramer, it was the writers. Did she have any input in the name Cosmo? He says, I don't know, and my uncle's dead, and I don't know her. So he said, that's my story. I just thought that was a cool story.
That is cool. It's someone else's story. It's not your story.
It's not my story, mm-hmm. No. But that was, and he says it much better with his thick, heavy Southern accent.
I'm sure. Yeah, no, that was very interesting.
So his name is Cosmo. But that came...
So believe it or not, we have listeners that got to listen to some part of that.
You didn't tell me we had listeners.
Well, we're broadcasting live. They can just drop in and drop out.
So how many are we up to?
Those of you who, we were at five, we're at four now. I don't know if the five.
I bored one. You got to tell me when, or I would have.
So those of you who are listening, if you've been waiting for Jim to finish his story so you could call in, now's the time. Phone number is 970-530-0556. In the meantime, we will
answer a question.
Cover an email question, but
should
feel
we try
free to
get,
call in anytime.
Brandon on the phone? Brandon's is one of them
gonna, Brandon? No. Laura's going to let us know when Brandon calls in.
Okay. So we will not answer Brandon's question then right now.
Yep.
Okay.
How about let's knock out the NUA. Get that
I was going to say, let's do the NUA one first if we must. Okay, well, this question came in, and I'm assuming he means NUA. I haven't reached out to this gentleman for further clarification. I am going to reach out to him and tell him to listen to this show when it plays on iTunes. Probably this Saturday it'll be available. And if I have this wrong, if he's not talking NUA, then I'll ask him for further clarification. I'll see if he can actually call the show, and we'll answer it for him live. For those who – well, let me read his question first. Perfect. And then I'll explain what NUA is. It begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris."
You're still using your Southern accent.
I know. I just noticed that. See? My Southern accent builds in because I do it so well.
Sure.
Well, to me it was a good Southern accent. You don't think that Southern accent was good?
That's kind of South Boston. Yeah, it's getting kind of hot in here. You can turn the heater off?
I'm turning the heater
off.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, begins. "Hi, Jim and Chris." Mm-hmm. "I just discovered your podcast and like the depth you go into." So this is a fan, obviously.
About Seinfeld.
Well, I'm sure there's other listeners who are going to find Cosmo's story interesting. "I just discovered your podcast. I like the great depth you go into. I understand there is a special way to distribute the 401k from my prior employer in order to minimize future taxes. My question is, should I do it now or wait? Other people in my company have already done it, so I know the plan allows it. And I was over the age of 55 when the company I work for was sold. And now I'm 58 years old." And he put off to the side, "My wife is 56. The wife's age isn't going to apply when we're talking about NUA, but anyways, he has it in there. "We are both still working. We recently have been doing very well." Maybe perhaps in the past they weren't doing as good as they are now. "And our combined income is and pension is close to $500,000 a year." So between their income and they've turned on a pension, between pension and income, they're making $500,000 a year. "We have three parts to my 401k. After tax money of $590,000. Before tax money of $700,000. And an ESOP, employee stock ownership plan, for those listening who don't know what ESOP is, an ESOP of $508,000 with a cost basis of $42,000. Mm. It's making NUA look very attractive now, doesn't it?
A lot of appreciation there.
Okay. "The after-tax money will be rolled into a Roth IRA. The ESOP will be converted to regular shares. I will pay taxes on $42,000 at that time. Future sales of the stock will be taxed at capital gains tax rates. Before tax money will be rolled over to an IRA. My question is, should I do it now or wait?" So I want to delve into this a little, help our listeners understand. He's got a lot of moving parts here.
It's a good question because there are a lot of people out there that end up with stock shares of their employer inside of some type of retirement plan. And there are times when those can be handled in a special way that other investments in your retirement plans are not affected in that same way. So it's good that he's looking into this.
So what he's talking about, folks, is a couple of moving parts. He has three retirement plans. He really has two retirement plans, an ESOP and a 401k. The 401k is divided almost equally between a traditional 401k and a Roth 401k, hence the three pools of money. We've talked openly on this show that in October of 2000, and gosh, now I'm not sure if it was 14 or 15, the IRS released some very specific rules and opinions. If anybody needs it, just email me. Go to our website, jimhelps.com, or send me an email, jim@jimhelps.com. And I can tell you exactly if it was 2015 or 2016. Well, actually, no, I can't. Not on this. I can tell you on my computer. I'm on my iPad. I have a newsletter from the Ed Slot Group specifically walking you through on how to take a Roth 401k and when you leave your employer, move the after-tax money to a Roth IRA and the pre-tax money to an IRA. So if anybody needs that specific email, I'll be happy to send it to you.
There is a way to do that and to separate them out properly.
There's a right way and a wrong way. And I don't know if he has the money in a Roth 401k. He doesn't indicate that. He says pre-tax and post-tax. If that's mixed into the traditional 401k, it's not as easy then if he has half a million dollars in a Roth 401k and $500,000 in a traditional 401k. Those are very easy to move. It's when they're mixed, and I'm under the assumption they're mixed.
Right, the way he describes it, because he didn't talk about it as a Roth 401k. Right. He talks about it as after-tax money
and
in his 401k. So that's instead of having two separate cups of coffee and cream, he's got them essentially mixed together. There is sometimes no way to unmix them, but in this case, if you do it right, you can unmix them and split them properly to go into a Roth IRA and traditional IRA. That's what Jim's talking about. This document from the Slot Group will give you the specifics on how to make that happen.
It's about an 8-page newsletter that delves into the nuances of how to do this. So I want to warn him, even though you can do it, it's not quick and easy, and you have to make sure you do it right. So if what I'm describing, listeners, what you're trying to do, get a hold of me and I'll send you that newsletter. In fact, any listener can get a hold of me and I'll send you that newsletter. The other money he has, Chris, is in an ESOP plan, an employee stock ownership plan. Now, I just came back from the Ed Slot program. We talked on Saturday morning for 3 hours. We covered NUA.
Nice.
So
it's fresh.
Too bad you weren't there, because I know how much you love this.
Well, I like when other people talk about it.
And they delved into this deeper than I've ever delved into it before. So they you talk about going down a rabbit hole like I do. They were rabbit holing everywhere. But they delved deeply in, and one of the things they pointed out was ESOPs. So, listener, ESOPs may be eligible for net unrealized appreciation, but only if it is a qualified ESOP, and you need to make sure it is. Now, he talks that people at his company, Chris, have done this, so I'm going to assume he has a qualified ESOP.
Yeah.
But if it's a non-qualified ESOP, this is not allowed, and be very careful. But other people wouldn't be doing NUA if it wasn't a qualified ESOP. So now, for all our listeners who have no idea what in the hell I'm talking about, what is NUA? NUA stands for Net Unrealized Appreciation. And let's round these numbers, Chris, a little differently. He said, and I'll let you do the numbers. He said he has 508,000 of company stock in an employee stock ownership plan.
Yep.
Let's just say it's 500,000.
Okay.
He said the cost basis is 42,000. Let's just say it's 40. So now it's round numbers.
Yes.
He has $500,000 in an ESOP. We're going to assume, listeners, it's a qualified ESOP, which means it's available to all employees. It works very similar to a 401k, but it only contains employer stock. And it's going to qualify, hence the name qualified, it's going to qualify for tax treatment, deferred tax treatment, and net unrealized appreciation. So if he has this money, listeners, in a qualified ESOP, he has $500,000. If he moved it to an IRA, which is what most people think they're going to do, so he's going to take $500,000 and move it to an IRA. Out of that $500,000, $440,000 is appreciation in the stock. $460,000 is appreciation in the stock. $40,000 is basis. Basis traditionally would be the price he paid. But in the case of a qualified plan, it's not. For NUA purposes, basis refers to the price of the stock when it was put into the ESOP.
So essentially when he earned the stock as a bonus or however the compensation he was paid, it was the value of the stock at that time. And then the thing has really grown to $500,000.
Exactly. So it may or may not be after-tax basis. Chances are it's not. Chances are the stock was put in as part of an incentive package, perhaps, to stay working there. Or he was allowed to, obviously he purchased it at very low prices. He was allowed to purchase stock. Maybe it was a private company before it went public. He talks in his email how his company was taken over. If he's making $500,000 a year, I'm thinking tech worker. I'm thinking he was paid private stock, Chris, originally in the ESOP. As an incentive. And remember how he wrote, recently we're doing very well. A lot of these tech workers do not make much money at first, and instead they're compensated in these ESOP programs where they get stock put in at pennies on the dollar, saying, hey, keep working for us. When we're bought out, your ESOP's going to be worth a lot of money. That's what I'm thinking happened here, but I don't know for sure.
Reasonable story, though.
Okay. So when we say basis in an ESOP, listeners, we don't necessarily mean this was after-tax money. He's probably never paid taxes on it yet. But it's basis in the sense of it was the value of the stock on the day it was put into the employee stock ownership plan. Okay? Now, most employers track the basis of all the stock in the ESOP as one. It's called average share price. Very rarely do they do individual shares. If they do individual shares, we are tracking every single stock certificate that was put in for you. You could have literally hundreds of different
individual cost bases.
Exactly.
Base I.
As Ed warned us, if your client is keeping track of it individually, you had better, before you leave, get all that basis information. But most companies who will track basis for you do it by the average share method, and Ed says it's the easiest way. So I'm guessing, I don't think all this money was put in all at once for him. I think it was throughout his employment there, and the employer is keeping track of average share price. So they're saying to him, the average price of the stock when we put it in the ESOP for you, or when you bought it in the ESOP, if it wasn't a startup company, if you was in an established company, they generally let you buy it in the ESOP at a discount. And it's usually bought in the public market. I'm assuming it was private. I could be totally wrong, but I'm just looking at his numbers and the way he wrote things, and I'm thinking that he was working for a tech company before it became big. So he has $40,000 of basis that hasn't been taxed, $460,000 again that hasn't been taxed. If he moved that money to an IRA, which he's allowed to do in a qualified ESOP plan, move it to an IRA, sells it inside the IRA, still no taxes. So he could sell it inside the IRA and get diversification if he's worried about having too much of his assets tied up in one stock. And what happens, though, Chris, if he takes that money out?
Well, now the money that comes out of that IRA is all considered earnings and is taxed at normal income tax rates, which most people know if they're exposed to some tax situation like this. There's a difference between capital gains tax rates and regular income tax rates. So there are advantages to capital gains rates. Capital gains rates we usually don't talk about with an IRA because every dollar that comes out is considered income. It was the money that went in was deferred income. The growth that was in there is tax deferred. When it comes out, you don't track things like the basis on the stock and look at capital gains over long periods of time versus short periods of time, any of that. None of that is relevant because every dollar that comes out of the IRA is recorded as income and taxed at your regular income tax rates for that year when you're filing your taxes. That's what normally happens. In this case, he has an alternative.
Correct. When you look at your 401k, listeners, you may see an asset. If this man took this money from the ESOP and moved it to an IRA, he may still see $500,000 in his previous employer's stock. But the IRS doesn't see an asset. They see income. They don't give a damn that it's invested in stocks. They see income. They see $500,000 of income that has not been taxed. NUA, net unrealized appreciation, is a strategy to turn an asset that the IRS would view as income and instead get them to view it as an asset.
As an investment. Yep.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So what does NUA mean? Net unrealized appreciation. He has, I don't think anyone listening would dispute, he has a very big unrealized gain. Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, I think all $500,000 is taxable to him. I don't think the $42,000 is after-tax cost basis. I think it was the value of the stock on the day his employer put it in there for him. I'm still going...
So that part, he's likely going to be paying income tax rates
on the basis
on
as
because
well.
Because it's deferred income tax.
Correct.
But the gain from the $40,000 to the $500,000, if he does it right, there's something he can do about that.
Correct. How would you like to take, listeners, an asset that if you move it to an IRA, you are going to have to pay income taxes on it, which could be as high as 40% if you do it wrong. In other words, you have a lot of money, and he is making a lot of money. He's making $500,000 a year. He would definitely be taxed at the 20% tax capital gains rate. Add on another 3.8% from his IRA for the Obamacare tax credit. He's at 23.8% cap gain. How would you like to turn it into perhaps a, instead of, excuse me, he wouldn't it be a cap gain.
If it were a cap gain, that's would be
that's,
at.
If
he recognized
gain.
It as income.
Income, 39.6.
Almost double.
Right. So if he moves it to an IRA, it's all income. It's going to come out with $500,000 of income right now. He's going to put more money on top of that. It's going to be taxed at 39.6. Plus, he's in Connecticut, mm-hmm. high tax state. He's going to have Connecticut income taxes on top of that. And depending on what city in Connecticut, he may have local income taxes on top of that. Connecticut is a high tax state. So he could easily lose half of it to taxes, income taxes. Net unrealized appreciation lets employees who are working for a company and have just employer stock, not other company stock, just employer stock in a qualified retirement account, 401k or qualified ESOP, not a non-qualified ESOP, but qualified ESOP, allows them a special tax treatment to get money out of that ESOP or 401k and pay just capital gains, long-term capital gains, which could be in his high income bracket, about 23.8 instead of 50%.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be definitely more than 40.
Right, with the state factor.
With the state factor.
Yep.
Now I think I have listeners' ears peaked. How do we do this? That's a 100% savings on taxes.
Well, no. That'd be no tax. 50% savings.
50% savings. Yeah. Excuse me. Well, 100%, well, it could be 100% savings.
Increase.
If after he retires and he's no longer making $500,000,
low income,
he
mm-hmm.
spends money from taxable accounts and Roth IRAs, shows no income, takes it out in the 15% tax bracket, it's 100% tax free.
Mm-hmm.
So you could go from losing half to paying nothing. Now do I have your attention, listeners? So how does NUA work? What it allows people to do who have highly appreciated company stock in a qualified employer-sponsored retirement plan. Notice we said highly appreciated. Chris, does this man have highly appreciated stock?
He does.
What does that mean? It means he has $40,000 in and it's worth $500,000.
Yeah.
He has $460,000 of untapped gain, and I think that's pretty damn high.
It is.
Yeah, in my opinion, quite high. So what the strategy entails, though, is you have to take a lump sum distribution from all like accounts of that employer in 1 year and move it all out of the employer accounts in 1 year. And it's not 1 year from the date you do it, Chris. It's one calendar year.
Yeah.
We have 2 months of the year left. I would not attempt this right now if I was this listener. He asked me my question, should I do it now or wait? My answer, wait.
Wait till 2018.
Wait a few more months. Now you have 12 months to do it. You start trying to do it now, it's almost November 1st. You're going to be knee-deep in the middle of the Turkey Day holiday and the Christmas holiday and the New Year's Eve and the New Year's Day holiday. You may never get this done. And if you do it wrong, you could be hit with a massive tax. So you got to do it right. But the strategy entails, folks, you have to close all like employer accounts, meaning this is a defined contribution plan, a ESOP and a 401k are defined contribution plans. If he has a pension at that employer, that's a defined benefit plan. That doesn't matter. You can leave that account. You don't have to do anything about that. But all defined contribution plans for that employer have to be closed in 1 year. All of them and all the money moved. So what he has to do is look at the employer's 401k, Chris, and ESOP together. And both those accounts need to be closed. And the 401k is mixed with pre-tax and after-tax. And he has to do that special ruling that came out in October of 2015 of the rules to follow to get the after-tax money in the 401k into a Roth and the pre-tax money into an IRA. That alone is a nightmare to do. Mm-hmm.
That's why you want a whole year to be working on this.
Yes. So he has to move that money, even though they're in two separate accounts, Chris. One's a 401k, one's an ESOP. They're like accounts. Yep. They're both defined contribution plans. So both need to be fully closed, not partially closed, fully. Not one red cent left in them. So he has to move the 401k to two separate IRAs. One's a Roth IRA, one's a traditional IRA. To me, I would do that first, listener. Mm-hmm. Get that all set. Don't start this till January of next year. So in January, he does that. Mm-hmm. Then he has the ESOP. Here's what he does, listeners, with the ESOP. He takes 100% of that stock out. He doesn't sell
the
stock.
No, it has to come out as stock.
Correct. Mm-hmm. He doesn't sell it and take cash. He has to take 100% of that stock out of the ESOP as a like distribution. They call it a like asset distribution. They're going to distribute the stock. Most 401ks will actually distribute stock of the employer. Mutual funds inside the 401k or separately managed accounts, they'll sell and give you cash. But employer stock, they'll issue. Every ESOP I have ever seen will always distribute the stock unless it's stock of a private company and they will not let you own it anywhere but in the ESOP. There are a few very big breweries in Fort Collins where we live, Chris. Well, you live there. I just work here. That are employee-owned through ESOPs.
Right. But there's no market for the stock outside.
No, you've got to sell it right back to the ESOP.
Right, which means no NUA.
NUA won't work for them. Yep. So the stock has to be distributable. You have to be able to take the 401k out of the stock. See, now I got all messed up. You got to be able to take the
stock shares
out of the ESOP as well. You could distribute them. There it is. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say distribute them. You have to be able to distribute them out of the ESOP as stock. Now, he said people have been doing this, so I would assume it is okay to do. It's not.
Hopefully these people have been doing it right.
Right. So now, listeners, follow my logic here. He has $40,000 of basis, half a million dollars total, $460,000 a gain. And I just told him, Chris, to take a 100% distribution out of the ESOP. Do not put this money in an IRA.
No.
Do not roll this money to an IRA. You're going to put it in a regular taxable brokerage account.
Yep.
Am I foolish?
No, because you know how NUA works. It sounds foolish for people who are typically doing rollovers from a 401k into an IRA. They do that so that they don't have to recognize a huge gob of income in 1 year, which it appears with your advice to distribute the whole thing, what you're telling this person to do, but it's not true. It's not true because of NUA. They're taxed. He is going to have a certain amount that is recognized as a distribution of income from the account. And how much is that? Oh, Jim's typing.
I'm typing, sorry.
I shocked him with a question. So remember, in his assumption here, we don't have the details for absolute sure on this, but his assumption is the 40 grand of basis was not has not yet been taxed, or are we assuming it had been taxed?
Let's just pretend it hasn't been taxed. It's typical basis in an NUA.
Yeah, so here, that part is going to be recognized as income. It was deferred income. You were paid this stock share instead of income at some point in the past, and you didn't pay tax on it at the time. The IRS says, well, you owe us taxes on that. You're going to recognize that part as income. But the rest of it, from the 40 up to the 500,000, we're going to give you the ability to treat that gain as if you'd had this stock out in a regular brokerage account this whole time, during the entire time that there was gain. And therefore, you get to incur, like taxes are a good thing, but in this case, it is a good thing. You can be exposed now to capital gains rates, long-term specifically, rather than short-term income tax rates, which in our illustration may be a 50% reduction in the tax that he owes, 50% or more, depending on the situation when he actually sells these shares.
Exactly. So if he takes out, remember, both accounts, listeners, have to be closed in 1 year. That's why we're telling him not to try it this year. It's already November by time this plays. But next year, he moves the 401k first. Hopefully, listener, you contact me and ask. I'll send you the Ed Slott 8-page document on how to do this. And you follow those rules to the T, and you separate that 401k. The pre-tax money goes into an IRA. The post-tax money, which is almost another $500,000, goes into a Roth IRA. Boom, that's beautiful. That's done. And then also within the year, you take your ESOP, you move it to a taxable account. When you do that, the IRS will not tax that $500,000 distribution. You heard that right, folks. He took a $500,000 out of a qualified employer account that if he left it in there and moved it to an IRA, the IRS is going to look at that as income and tax it as income.
As he takes it out. But all of it is income.
All of it as income. And the state of Connecticut, which is a high tax state, is going to tax it as income. And if he lives in a municipality that taxes income, they're going to tax it as income. Instead, he's going to move $500,000 out and owe no taxes except on the basis. And he's saying the basis is about $40,000. I'd go so far as to say the basis isn't on 40. I don't think he's paid taxes on that basis, but it doesn't matter. The basis that's taxable to you is the value of the stock, whether it's pre-tax or post-tax, it doesn't matter. So the $40,000 is always going to be taxable to him, even if it's after tax. It gets confusing, but the basis is what comes out, and that is taxable to him, folks. It's taxable to him in the year he takes it, next year, 2018. The man's making $500,000 a year. He's going to pay 40% taxes on that. Oh, horror. He's going to have to pay 40% taxes on $40,000. The other $460,000 sits in his account tax-free or tax deferred for the moment. But now instantly the IRS sees an asset, not income. They view that stock not as income to be taxed, but as an asset to maybe be taxed. If he has charitable donations, if he has loss carry forwards from previous years, he may be able to get out of that money tax-free, Chris. You cannot deduct losses on distributions from an IRA, but you can deduct losses on the sale of a stock. Excuse me.
So he essentially has exposed himself to all There are advantages to holding assets outside of a retirement account. there's advantages to having them in, but it's not all good news. For one thing, all that money that eventually comes out at income tax rates. There are times, obviously, that capital gains tax rates are preferable to income tax rates. So in this case, he has control. He can actually switch it. It's like flipping a switch. And instead of all this money being exposed to income tax rates as he ultimately distributes it and spends it, he's flipped the switch, and the vast majority of it in his case, the $460,000 worth of gain that, you know, may or may not stay. Of course, the stock can always go down in value and that might shrink. But for the mean, you know, in the meantime, he's got this this potential gain that, if treated improperly, could be fully taxed at income tax rates and instead could be at much more preferable.
Oh, he is a prime
capital
candidate.
Oh, he's definitely, this is a textbook example of when you apply and do the strategy of NUA.
Absolutely. He was made for NUA here. Mm-hmm. So what he now does, listeners, I don't know why, but all of a sudden I can't talk.
Because you're drinking your Starbucks.
No, I'm not drinking Starbucks.
Well, you did before.
Water.
It's giving you a buildup.
So now, again, listeners, sorry about this, but my voice is totally gone. So now he has $460,000 of capital gain. And he can sell it the very next day, listeners. I don't recommend it, but he could. And you might think, well, now it's a short-term hold. He's only held it for one day. NUA, folks, is always taxed as a long-term capital gain, no matter how long you hold it. So he puts the $460,000 in a taxable brokerage account, sells it the very next day, he would pay long-term capital gains on it. If, let's just pretend he had $460,000 of losses, long-term capital gain losses from a bad investment, he just got that money out tax-free, Chris. Whereas if he moved it to an IRA and then took it out, he could take $3,000 of his $460,000 long-term capital losses and write off ordinary income. But that's it. The remaining $457,000 would be subject to income taxes. Doing it as an NUA, it would be tax-free, mm-hmm, because the $460,000 of long-term capital gain is totally offset by long-term capital losses. Now, if he puts the $460,000 in 2018, remember the only taxes he has to pay is on the $40,000 of basis. That will be taxed to him as income in the year it was distributed. Now he has $460,000 of taxable gain, long-term taxable gain in his taxable brokerage account, and it grows to $660,000. Mm-hmm. So he has $100,000 of gain. The gain on top of NUA, it sits on top. This is like a layer cake. So the gain is going to sit right on top. And depending on when he sells the gain, it could be short term if he sells it within a year, or long term,
yep,
if he sells it after a year. But the NUA amount, the $560,000, is always long term capital gain. Couple other nuances. This is going to be subject to a 10% penalty, but not for him. So if other people are listening, remember what he wrote. He separated from service after the age of 55. So because he left that employer after the age of 55, there is no 10% early withdrawal penalty, even though he's only 58. And if he starts to do this next year, he'll only be 59. He has to wait to 59 and a half normally to avoid the 10% penalty. There'll be no 10% penalty because he was over the age of 55 when he separated from service.
From this employer, which is where these accounts are held.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The 10% penalty, though, folks, even if it applied, would only apply to basis.
To the 40, right.
Never to the $460,000 of NUA. That saves him another $46,000. So let's just say he separated from service, Chris, at 53. He could still do it. He'd have to pay another 10% penalty on the $40,000 or another $4,000, but he wouldn't have to pay the 10% penalty on the $460,000 of NUA. Now, one downside to NUA, folks, because there are some downsides to it, there's probably two big ones to be aware of. NUA never, I repeat, NUA never receives a step-up in basis at death of the owner. NUA is IRD to the IRS. What does that mean in English? Net unrealized appreciation is considered income with respect to the decedent. Even though it's not going to be taxed as income, it will be taxed as a capital gain, it still gets and still is treated as IRD, income with respect to the decedent. So the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, never allows IRD to be wiped out or stepped up, they call it in the industry. They never allow that tax burden, Chris, to be wiped out. Someone will always pay taxes on IRD. So even though they still categorize net unrealized appreciation as income with respect to decedent, they will tax it as a capital gain, not as income. They'll treat it as an asset, not as deferred income, but they're not going to allow that asset to get a step up in basis.
Right.
The growth on top, in my hypothetical, I said he put the the $460,000 in. It now grew to $660,000. That $200,000 of capital gain would receive a step up in basis,
right.
But the NUA amount, that $460,000, is locked in. The NUA amount is locked in.
And kind of attached to the person who it belonged to in the first place.
Now, the other negative is he still has $500,000 into this company's stock. And if the money was in an IRA, if he moved it to an IRA, rebalancing is a hell of a lot easier. He can if he thinks I've got way too much stock in this company, or let's just say he is in the tech industry, I think the tech market is overvalued, I think our company is not going to do as well anymore, it's going to lose half its value, and he wants to diversify before that happens. He can do that inside his IRA, no problem. If he does it outside of the IRA, he could be hit with a big capital gains issue in order to rebalance. So
yeah, but to avoid a
I'm just
a
pointing
huge,
out some of the
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, it's
so one way around that, folks, is to take some of that money. Let's say he wants to lighten up half of it. So he can take $200,000 of NUA and gift it to a charitable remainder trust that he sets up. He puts the money into the CRT and he sells it. Inside the charitable remainder trust, it is now locked in as a long-term capital gain. The charitable remainder trust starts sending 5% of that long-term capital gain out to him every year. So instead of receiving it all at once, he receives it over the next 20 years at 5% a year. And he'll have to pay long-term capital gains, not income, long-term capital gains until all that distributed capital gain is sent out to him. There are some nuances. I'm really dumbing that strategy down, but that is a way because he can sell it inside the charitable remainder trust tax-free. He can rebalance inside the charitable remainder trust if he so desired, or he can distribute some of that money. Let's say he's retiring and he wants to start living off of this. He can do that, and he would be able to get an income tax deduction for the money put into the charitable remainder trust minus the net present value of the 20-year income payment. So it's not quite the same. As I said, the CRT strategy would get into a more advanced planning strategy, goes beyond the scope of this. But if he did want to rebalance, look at a charitable remainder trust as an option. So that's how NUA works. It's a really interesting strategy, but it has to be done in 1 year. So one other warning to you, listener. You said you are 58 now and that you separated from service at 55. If you took one red cent out of your 401k or ESOP between the period of time you retired and the time you're listening to this, you blew it. You cannot do NUA right now. So wait. Do not do this, listener, if you took one red cent out of your employer 401k, whether that was a direct withdrawal or you moved it to an IRA. If you moved money from the employer 401k, or if you took any stock or any money out of the ESOP between retirement and listening to this, you blew your chance to do NUA. Why do I say that? What did I say earlier? Lump sum. All money has to be removed in 1 year, one calendar year, not one fiscal year. That's why we're saying not to try it now if you qualify, because you only have 2 months of 2017 left. Wait 2 months and a day, and you have 12 months to get this right. So if you took any money out, you can't do it. But all is not lost. NUA is eligible to people via triggering events. There's four triggering events. Separation from service, which this man has done. Reaching age 59 and a half.
Not yet for this person.
Dying, which probably isn't high on his priority list.
Right.
And becoming disabled, which also isn't high on his priority list. Disability is not available to self-employed people. He's not self-employed. So separation from service, reaching age 59 and a half, and death are the ones that he'll be able to do. Disability, if memory serves me correct, is only available to self-employed people. Separation from service is not available to self-employed people, only to employed people. So he's not self-employed, so don't worry about that. So his next trigger event, Chris, because he's only 58, is 59 and a half. So when he exceeds 59 and a half, not in the year he turns 59 and a half, but after age 59 and a half, that's another triggering event. Triggering events, just, it's like you're cocking the hammer back on an old revolver. A triggering event just cocks that hammer back. When you pull the trigger, when you decide to, can be 5 years later, 10 years later. But the minute you take one red cent out of that retirement account, you have to get the rest of that account closed in the same year for NUA to count.
Yep.
So he never told us in his email if he took any money from his 401k or his ESOP. If he didn't, I still wouldn't do it this year, listener. I would start it next year. And I would move the 401k first, following the special rules that you have to follow to make sure the $500,000 in the Roth, the $500,000 of after-tax money in your 401k goes to a Roth, and the pre-tax money goes to an IRA. Once that's done, then attack the NUA, which will be a little bit easier. You're just going to open up a brokerage account, work with the custodian of your ESOP, and I'm sure they're very familiar with this, and you're going to transfer all the money.
The shares. Now, not the money, the shares.
The shares. Mm-hmm. Now, listeners might be thinking, Jim, when a qualified account is paid out to someone, either as cash or as an in-kind distribution, doesn't 20% of that money have to, by law, go to the IRS? Yes, except what, Chris?
When they distribute stock.
When you distribute only stock of that company. You can distribute another company stock. You're going to have to pay taxes on it. There is no withholding automatically sent to the IRS when the only asset being distributed at that time and the only asset in the account is employer stock. So make sure the ESOP just has employer stock, which I'm sure it does. Close the traditional 401k first, get that moved. Then there's no withholding, Chris. So there's no 20% withholding that's going to go to the IRS and mess this all up. All $500,000 will move right into a brokerage account, and he only has to pay income taxes on the basis, which for him is $42,000. $460,000 sits in there as a long-term capital gain, no matter when he sells it, a long-term capital gain. If he plays his cards right and builds up Roth money, he's going to have $500,000 in a Roth. If when he finally stops working, he starts spending from that Roth and spending from other brokerage assets, he could stay in what is right now the 15% bracket and have absolutely zero long-term capital gain period, and he'll be able to take out some. He won't be able to take it out all, but over the next several years, start taking out money from that ESOP, selling some of that stock tax-free. Because people in the 15% tax bracket pay no capital gains if you're in the 10 or 15% tax bracket. So this is a tax planning window for him. Mm-hmm. You call it window. I call it tax hole. Justin calls it tax void. He's going to have a wonderful tax hole void window. When he finally stops working, he's going to have $500,000 in a Roth. And however much he has in a regular bank account, he lives off of that, shows no income, and starts liquidating the money in his former ESOP. It's now in a brokerage account. He starts selling some of that NUA stock, and he'll get it tax-free. It's a wonderful strategy.
Yep. So that was
a long answer.
Kind of a long answer, but... And that essentially is the Retirement and IRA Show podcastian edition this time.
That was
a full hour. Yeah.
Well, I do want to say...
Brandon, we can...
Is Brandon on the phone?
Brandon is not. He had another client, so we'll have to go to Brandon's estate planning question next week.
Next week.
Maybe we can get that right off the bat, because I think it is an interesting question. It has to do with a special needs trust and...
No, it's a different one.
Oh, well, we have another question on special needs trust and naming the trust as beneficiary
Correct.
Of the IRA, whether you should do that, in what cases, all that kind of stuff. So what were you going to say, Jim?
I just wanted to say, if anybody out there is trying to deal with NUA and you're afraid to do it alone, get a hold of us. We do work with people throughout the country, even though we're based in Colorado. We work nationally. So you can reach out to us and we can counsel with you and help you make sure you do it right. And to reach us, just go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. And all the information of how to reach us is under the Contact Us button.
Perfect. So we will be back next week with another live show, to the best of my knowledge, which will be at 3:30 p.m. Mountain Time. If you're listening to this on the podcast, you want to call in live. We didn't have a live caller this particular show, but the phone lines were open. We're happy to answer your questions via email, as Jim mentioned, but a live call would be exciting. I think we've had one live call so far in the infancy of the live version.
We had my mom, too.
And we had your mom, too. But if you'd like to call in next week at 3:30 Mountain Time on Monday, which if you're listening to this on the podcast, could be any moment now because the podcast doesn't go up until Saturday. So if you're available Monday afternoon, give us a call. Ask us a question. Be great to hear from you on the Retirement and IRA Show live edition. But we'll be seeing you next week. Have a great week. And before you go, if you would like to listen to our interview with Barry James from James Investment Research, stay tuned. I'll be back with you right after this short break.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado. Rocky Mountain High.
Well, welcome everybody to the Retirement and IRA Show Colorado edition. This is the show that is broadcast locally here in Northern Colorado every Saturday morning at 8 a.m.
Now, on today's show, folks, this is the Retirement and IRA Show Colorado edition. Today's show, we will be spending it talking with Barry James of James Investment Research. He is actually CEO of James Investment Research and president of the James Advantage Funds. Barry is an undergraduate of Colorado's very own United States Air Force Academy. He was a pilot. And we'll actually be talking to him, Chris. He jokingly referred to how he left the Air Force, where he was taught to fly at supersonic speeds, 200 feet above ground, through the mountains while being shot at. And he left that industry to enter something with more risk. and that would be investment management.
Right. Right.
And we'll have him talk about that because, as he put in his weekly email update to all his readers, I am an avid reader of Barry and read him every week. This marks the 30th anniversary of the crash of 87. And I'll have him share the story, as he put in his email. Timing is everything, they say, and he has some pretty darn good timing about the crash in 1987. We'll have him share when he comes on. But anyways, Barry received his master's degree from Boston University, a very fine institution of advanced learning, I may add.
Who let in people who shall remain
nameless.
I can't even speak today.
Wow. Yes, they did let me in to Boston University, but they let Barry in too, so I'm in good company. But very fine institution of advanced learning, Boston University. As I said, he joined James Investment Research after a stint in the U.S. Air Force, and he is company spokesman and makes frequent national television appearances on CNBC, MarketWatch, Fox Business, and Bloomberg TV, to name just a few. He's also been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and other fine publications. He needs to embellish his bio here, Chris.
And he's add the Retirement
IRA
show.
Right, the Retirement IRA show. Yeah. He's not even mentioning the Retirement IRA show. I mean, it stands above all of those.
Well, maybe when he appears on CNBC and those places, that's how they read
us.
It. Mentions, yeah. Last week when I was on the Retirement IRA show.
Exactly. Hey, you never know. He should be talking about that. But without further ado, we're going to open up the phone lines and bring Barry on. Barry, are you there today?
I am, oh nameless one.
Oh nameless one, yes. So seeing as I cannot remember, are you a Bengals or Browns fan?
I have a bag on my head, but I'm still a Bengals fan.
I see. Well, he's also not restricted to just those two.
There's no more.
There's actually some people in that area of the country that follow the Steelers.
College football.
Or the Steelers.
Even. College,
it's
Ohio
all
State.
Kind of all close, relatively close back there.
True.
We have one professional team in Ohio, and it's Ohio State.
That's what I was going to say.
The Ohio State.
Yeah, do you know why?
The Ohio State.
Every time they, you know how they, at the beginning of a game, the players say where they went to school? It's always the Ohio State. Is that really the name, and did you have to accentuate the?
I don't know about accentuating, but it is the name, and the yes, Ohio they State. Do say it.
So is it the Colorado State University?
No, it's not. No.
But it could be one day. You never know.
Maybe so.
Oh, my gosh.
Hold on, Barry. My coffee's coming.
We have to apologize to Barry. He's world-renowned.
In the middle of an interview, my coffee delivery came.
My goodness.
So do you relish the Starbucks triple pump decaf skim, no whip pumpkin spice latte like yours truly?
I don't think I've ever had one, so I don't know.
You don't know what you're missing. You've been on CNBC, quoted in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, and you've never had a pumpkin spice latte.
Never.
Well,
nor have I.
Really?
Really. Yeah.
You two don't know what you're missing.
Apparently.
Okay, Barry, we got a lot I want to cover this month. We have you on once a month to talk to our Northern Colorado listeners about the markets. And in today's morning email, you shared a little story about timing, I guess you could say, in the sense of the market drop of 87. Do you remember that time?
Oh, yes, almost like it's yesterday.
It's hard to forget.
I was actually in an interview on that subject with a writer from Barron's. They didn't like it because we had a happy ending with our story, and so the editor cut it out. But anyways, 1987 was a great year. The market had been rocking and rolling, and then the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. And we had something at that time, two things going on. One was this virtuous cycle of the S&P 500 index. That was now the new hot investment. And so you'd buy it, and so a lot of people would buy the index, and so the index fund, and so it would go up, and so they'd buy more, and they kept buying more. And the other thing was something called portfolio insurance, which was supposed to protect you in case the stock market went down very quickly. And generally speaking, it was putting in an order to sell the stock, if it hit a certain level before it, totally got trashed. Well, that summer, in the summer of 87, we produced an analysis that we did, a special report called A Time for Caution. And if we'd have been geniuses, we would have set a time for panic.
Yeah.
Because the market was getting ready to fall about 40% in 40 days. It was a brutal time. And it kind of peaked out in August. But the Federal Reserve was steadily raising interest rates. People were far too optimistic. And so what happened was we had the market start to turn down in August. And then up until, the Friday before what they call Black Monday, which was on the 19th of October, 1987, the market was down about 18-19%. So our warning was good. We had lowered the amount of equities that we had in clients' accounts. And, we're always looking for opportunities to buy. And what we actually wrote that weekend, that weekly email that you get, what we put in there says we were looking for a waterfall type of decline to kind of indicate that things were over. And that's often the best time to buy is when everybody else is really afraid. Now,
so Monday was your fault, Barry? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know. But, when it started cascading downward, we went in to buy and buy as aggressively as we can, which was about 5 or 10% adding to clients' accounts that day. And we actually broke our computer. We'd never put in that many orders. We'd have done all the software itself, so we had to rewrite all the software so we could keep putting in the orders. And actually, I think it was, I don't know, maybe Payne Weber or one of those folks, they actually put it on their squawk box around the country. Oh, there's this respected company in the Midwest that's buying. And, of course, everybody was ignoring that, and they were selling that day. But the market was down 22% in one day, and then it bounced around afterwards. And finally, it bottomed out. All the stocks kind of did early in December, and then it took back off. So it wound up being one of the better years that we've ever had for our clients because we were able to sell high and buy low. So it wound up turning out pretty well for our clients. But you can't really predict whether the market's going to have a crash like that. We didn't know that it would be a crash that day. But you can measure risk levels. And that's the thing that, all investors, especially individuals out there doing it on their own, that is something that they should keep an eye out on.
Yeah, I know you personally, well, your firm itself, maybe not you personally, I don't want to speak for you, but your firm, I guess if we were to sum it up, would saying you guys are contrarian investors be reasonably accurate?
I'd say that's entirely accurate. To really do well in any investment area, you have to go against the grain, and that's to buy when everybody's selling and to sell when everybody's buying. And it's really, really hard to do because your gut tells you you're stupid. How can you do this? You're doing the exact wrong thing. But that is what consistently works. And that's why we try to get our emotions out of it as much as we can. We've quantified a lot of measurements for risk and the like. So we're not just relying on our gut. And if I relied on my gut, I wouldn't be doing this business I'm in right now.
Well, one thing you put in the email, and for anybody who doesn't receive Barry's firm's market commentary, it comes out every Monday morning. They can go to your website. It's James Investment Research, but they shortened it down to J-I-R. J as in James, I as investment, R as in research. J-I-R-INC for incorporated, jir-inc.com. Go to that website and sign up for Barry's weekly email every Monday morning. It's very insightful. You put in here, Barry, I'm reading from the email, you put, you have to go all the way back to 1987 to find a time, and you're talking about right now. You would have to go all the way back to 1987 to find a time when institutional investors have been so overwhelmingly bullish. So you're essentially saying that you see maybe a lot of similarities. I don't want to speak for you, but do you see you lived through 87. In 87, I didn't even know what investing was. Are you saying you're seeing a lot of signs today, all the optimism we have today, the bullishness, a new high almost every week being hit in the markets? Do you see a lot of similarities between now and 1987?
I do see those, but no market peak and aftermath is the same from one time to the next. But yes, obviously we see the level of bullishness by institutions, and that's measured in a couple ways. You can see the surveys of them, how many are bullish and how many are bearish. And if you're bearish, you're a pariah. You're thrown off the island now. You can't say anything bad. But also we see them doing not just paying lip service to it, but mutual funds, they keep a certain amount of cash on hand, and it's the lowest level, maybe, you know, record level low, which is saying they've got every penny they can possibly get into the market, because they're afraid of being left behind. And one thing that is somewhat similar, and it doesn't mean that the market will have a correction, but in 1987, the market downturn had no relationship to a downturn in our economy. I think the only time in modern market history where you had a major downturn without it being associated with a recession, as we saw in 2008, you know, recession then, and, you know, early 2000s as well. So we don't really see any type of recession right now. Actually, things are, you know, going fairly well. Earnings are going up. But the market has gone up at such an aggressive pace and valuations are so high. It just kind of sets things up for, you know, a potential, you know, pullback in the market that, you know, might catch some people by surprise.
So, Barry, do you have a way to, I guess there's optimism and the market goes up, and that isn't necessarily abnormal because historically the market goes up more than it goes down, thank goodness. Otherwise, investing would not be a thing people would want to do. But there's a certain point where you might consider things getting overly optimistic or manic. People just are irrationally, if you will, behaving in their enthusiasm about things going on. Is how do you gauge whether you've reached, you know, the markets have kind of reached that stage versus just day-to-day optimism about the economy and the markets being better next year than they were last year?
Yeah, that's a good question. Manias, if I can use that term, and I'm not necessarily saying that we are in one today, but people can make their own decision. There's several markers that you can use. The first is a very rapid and extreme run-up in the price of something that's not justified by the fundamental values of that particular investment, and that it then becomes common knowledge that it's a sure thing. You think of internet investing in the late 90s, housing, of course, you know, in the mid-2000s, and even gold in 2011.
And tulips in the 1600s.
Well, there you go. Those two, yeah. This is not just modern history, that's for sure.
For those who don't know, I just wanted to say, in case our listeners wonder what the hell I'm talking about, there was a tulip mania. Was it the 1600s in
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I do know tulips was selling, a tulip bulb was selling for the price of a house. I don't know how much houses sold for back then. I didn't even know you could buy a house back then. I thought you had to run out there, find a piece of land, ask the king for some land, and build one. But they were selling for the price of a house, I read in an article. But anyways, listeners.
Right up to the point where they didn't.
Yes. <right. laughs> But carry on, Barry, because I was just trying to explain to people what a mania is.
So a rapid and extreme run-up in prices, it becomes common knowledge, it's a sure thing. And then if there's a pathway for the average person to get involved, and then they all believe, well, I can get out of it before the price would actually fall. And then the last thing was any warning about this was seen as you're irrelevant and old-fashioned. And this really, you know, comes into the late 90s when we actually lost a lot of business because we wouldn't buy companies that didn't have earnings. And those were the stocks that were going up, the internet craze, as it were. And again, these companies with no earnings, just eyeballs or clicks, that was how they were being priced. And I remember this one client of ours said, I want to put all my money in this stock, Planet RX, which was a .com. And he said, I can just retire in luxury, you know, after a couple of months and that. And we warned him, and we wrote him, and we begged him, don't do it, don't do it. And indeed he did in 1999, and he lost all his money. So, you know, again, nobody would listen to the voice crying in the wilderness. So those are the things that you typically see. And you can look at today, have we had some run-up in prices, maybe not justified? Yes, some of the stocks, very much so. Maybe it's, you know, just a smaller segment. We've got that. But everybody wants to own them. If I think currently the Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, they call those the FANG stocks. And even Tesla, for that matter, a company with no earnings at all, but up, you know, 70-80% this year. So folks are really gotten on that bandwagon, and we've even had clients clamoring for, I want to have some FANG stocks. And we say, okay, but it's not going to be under our management. We're not going to charge you because we don't believe in those at this juncture. You might make a lot of money, but the risk is just too much. And that's the thing it always comes back to is looking at risk and how do you define risk. And, you know, the basics of investing, there's just one thing that everyone has to remember when it comes to investing. You take the least amount of risk to achieve your goal, period. End of sentence. End of lesson.
But when you're 9 years into a bull market, equities seem to reach new highs every day. People are starting to lose track of risk. I see it all the time. I tend to look at, and in the 2000s, when the first market correction happened, I was just entering the industry. I was I didn't get out of BU until 1996, and I didn't move to Colorado until 1999 when I got into the industry. But all too often, people, I don't think, at least in the 1990s, I remember, true story, I had no office when I first started. I operated out of the back of my Subaru. When I moved out here, I sold my car and bought a Subaru. So in the back of the Subaru, there was no internet back then like we have. I had banker's boxes. And inside the banker's boxes, you know, back then, Barry, we do have to give prospectuses out when clients buy an investment. But back then, we actually had to have the physical prospectuses. Today, we can give them email links or email them the prospectuses. So I had banker's boxes full of prospectuses in the back of the car, all my applications, and I would go to people's homes. And I went to this home. They were one of the first people that ever called me to chat with me. And I always remember we went into the house. The woman was doing most of the talking, not the man. And she said she was looking for an investment. They were close to retirement. They wanted to retire in a few years. So they wanted an investment that was safe. And she said, like the Standard & Poor's, she didn't call it Standard & Poor's, she said, like the S&P 500, she equated the S&P with safe. She actually said that to me. She says, I want something safe like the S&P 500. And then what she said next just floored me. I started questioning, what did I get myself into? Because she said to me, and I have to paraphrase because this happened so long ago, but she said, we don't expect a very high return, but I always remember this number. She said, somewhere around 15% a year would be good. I'm not making that up. That's what she wanted.
Safe 15%.
Safe 15%.
There's a whole lot of folks on Wall Street that love to find that too.
Well, this was 1999, early 2000, before the fall. And I just told her, that doesn't exist. And then she said, I'm talking with other financial planners, and there's one who tells me it does, and he can help me. And I said, you may want to work with him, and I left the home. And it was only a few months after that the crash started. I didn't see the crash coming. I wasn't clairvoyant like you were, Barry, writing a few months before the crash of 87. It's time to be cautious. Nobody knew in 2000 things were going to turn around as fast as they did. But that was the attitude back then. And unfortunately, I think we're starting to see a lot of that attitude now. A lot of people are just losing track of risk. And it does concern me. It's a little disconcerting. So when we come back, we're going to talk to Barry to see if he can define risk and maybe explain to us what's the difference, Barry, between gambling and investments. Let's just try to figure that out because there is a difference. And maybe you can share to us some of the difference between gambling and investing.
Okay, so when we come back here after this short break, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 1935, as we always do, as we honor the start of Social Security, which of course started back in 1935. This particular song was written by our good friend Cole Porter, our good 1935 friend, wrote a lot of good stuff back in 1935. So we'll find out what that song is right after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
It was just one of those things, just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. As we take a listen to one of the top songs from 1935, that is, I will have to admit, a more recent recording than 1935.
That sounds like Frank Sinatra.
No, it wasn't, but it was Frank Sinatra-esque. He did record that song later on, but this was covered by somebody else. I couldn't find a decent 1935 version.
So who was that?
That was actually the Starlight Orchestra and Singers.
He sounds like Frank Sinatra. Barry, did he sound like Frank Sinatra to you?
He did, indeed.
I think that was on purpose, but I don't think Frank was part of the Starlight Singers. I'll look that up while you guys are talking, because I don't think that's...
Well, I knew it wasn't Cole Porter.
No.
And well, I knew Cole it wasn't from 1935, things. Because it didn't have all that...
Right. No, I looked for one of those, but couldn't find it. That is Just One of Those Things, written by Cole Porter for the 1935 musical Jubilee. Then it was later featured in two Doris Day musicals, Lullaby of Broadway and Young at Heart. It was in the series finale of MASH.
That song?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
It's been in all kinds of things. Frank Sinatra and many other people have recorded it over the years. So very popular song. Roots back to the beginning of Social Security, 1935.
Well, that guy sounded eerily Lee.
Well, maybe it was. I'll look it up. Jeez, I didn't realize you had such a Frank Sinatra fetish.
I don't have a Frank Sinatra fetish. It's just that it sounded like Frank Sinatra. Even Barry said it sounded like
it
Frank
did.
Sinatra.
I admit it sounds kind of like it. Maybe it is. I'll look it up.
All right. Well, welcome back, Barry, and welcome back, listeners. This is the second half of the Retirement and IRA Show Colorado Edition. You're listening live on KFKA out of Greeley, Colorado. It should be somewhere a little after 8:30 in the morning on Saturday. What's the date today? November what? It's already November.
It's November 4th when this is playing.
Well, that's what I meant. That's what I said today, because that's when people are listening. It's already November 4th. So we're recording on the day before Valentine's Day. Not Valentine's Day. I always say
you
that.
Are so hooked on Valentine's
My
Day.
My gosh.
You have this unnatural attraction to
I do
Valentine's
not.
Day.
Today is
it that traumatic for you?
What's the holiday there? Halloween.
Halloween.
Day
tomorrow.
Before Halloween.
Yeah.
Today is October 30th, the day before Halloween. We are recording this show. It is our monthly investment show with Barry James of James Investment Research. And Barry, when we left, I had said maybe you could talk to our listeners about the difference, because I hear this all the time. There are either some people right now, Barry, who have jumped onto this investment bandwagon that the market's going to keep going up, and they are hell-bent, and they're just buying and buying. I call them the greater fool theory, the theory being that they'll find someone even a greater fool than them to buy whatever it is they're buying in the future, because it's just going to keep going up. But then you have people on the other end of the spectrum who are still too fearful to get in and never did get into the markets to any degree after the last fall, because it was such a severe and painful fall. So we have some people who think it's gambling to put any money in Wall Street. And I try to get those people to understand personally, this is my way of talking to them, unless you don't believe in mankind and humans and society and that we're always going to try to better ourselves and grow and expand, then yes, I agree, don't invest. But if I can get people to understand that when you're investing, there is risk without a doubt. You have to pay attention to valuations. You have to make sure you don't overpay for companies and you buy good companies. But you're actually investing, to me, in the human spirit. But they still feel it's gambling, not investing. How do you convince, or how do you approach it with your clients of the firm, James Investment Research? How do you guys handle the difference between what gambling would be and what investing would be?
That's a great question, and certainly we our minds try to grapple with this on a consistent basis. There's a couple things as I look at it to try to differentiate. And when you talk about the investment arena, stocks and bonds, we call gambling something a little different. We call it speculation, but it's still gambling in the end. And gambling is only a very, very short time frame. You're trying to get in and get out and make your money. It's immediate results. And investing is something that you're doing over a long period of time. I say if you're not in it at least 3 to 5 years, you're not investing. You are, in essence, gambling. So you have to give it the time to make progress. And the other thing, and when you gamble, the odds are against you. I think of blackjack, and I think there's a half of 1% favor to the house, and yet they make billions of dollars every year in these casinos for that very reason, because the odds are not with you. But investing, the odds are with you. I mean, if you go back in time, back to the 20s even, it's really hard to find a period over 10 years where you didn't make money in stocks. And, since 1926, stocks have done around 10% a year, doubling your money roughly every 7 years. Yeah, there's some periods when it's less than that. But it's a case where you're not going to lose it all in the stock market. Even if the market goes down 30-40%, you still have 60% left. So that's one of the things I like about it. And the other last thing, it's maybe a little different view on things. Gambling only benefits yourself. It really impacts you if you get a win or not. But investing really has an impact on all of society. There are factories built, people are hired, facilities, occupied, services created. There's so many good things, and like you say, as long as we have that going on, we're going to have a market for those companies that do those things, and that's how I would really differentiate between gambling and investing.
So you would definitely put day trading, these people who try to go on their computers, and I'd say that they're trying to use their computer like a slot machine and get in and get out, get in and get out, get in and get out real fast. That is definitely gambling. But people who buy and hold, keep costs low, have good management, maintain composure. I always say to me, it is behavioral finance that ruins most portfolios. It is the fear that people get as equities are going down, where they convince themselves they're going to go down forever, mostly driven by the media that is pushing a lot of this. So if you can just stick it out, and that's what, Chris, you and I talk a lot with our listeners. We call it, Barry, risk capacity. If we can show people that their portfolio can drop and they have the capacity to handle that drop, that they're not going to have to change their lifestyle or cut their spending or go without paying some of their bills, that everything that is needed over the shorter term, remember you were saying, Barry, that putting money in the markets for less than a 10-year period to you is gambling. So if you can get people to see risk capacity, they take or would have the ability, hopefully, to handle the risk of investing.
I think that's a great thing that you're doing for the folks that you're working with. And that's why I think having advisors involved with folks is so beneficial, because we all get caught up in our situation and what we hear our neighbor. I hear that all the time from my clients. Well, my buddy did this and that. And having an advisor to try to keep us, on path. A guy named Richard Thaler just won the Nobel Prize in economics, and he was really talking about that behavioral finance, as you mentioned, and that we humans have human weaknesses, and one of those is we don't tend to follow a disciplined approach when it comes to our investments and our decisions about money. And so anything that adds an overlay of that, I think, is a tremendous benefit to the typical person out there.
The other thing that I'd like to ask you, Barry, or at least comment, and that kind of was brought up in the past segment, in the previous segment, a lot of people lose sight of the fact that there's a difference between a good company and a good investment or a good stock, that there is one doesn't necessarily mean the other. And we see that a lot. There's a lot of common, and we don't have to name any particular companies, but there's companies that, you know, it might be a great place you want to go work, or it might produce a product or supply a service that everyone wants and loves, and it's a fabulous thing, and what they're producing is in huge demand. But you look at it as an investment, and it may not make any sense whatsoever, and people have to understand that difference, that there is truly a difference there. Would you agree with that, or...?
Absolutely. You know, when you think of the markets and what goes on, it's an auction. It's just an auction going on. And we've all watched those people, and maybe we've been one of those people ourselves at an auction, and we fall for something, we just fall in love with it, and someone else is bidding, and we keep bidding, and we know we're bidding more than the thing is worth, and we just keep bidding and bidding and bidding, and then we finally win, and we think, oh, what did I just do? And that's the way it is. And when it comes to investments and an auction-type market that we have, it's only worth what someone's willing to pay. And in some cases, people are willing to pay a lot more than the thing may really be worth. And that's the situation, you know, when I think about risk, that's when I start to get nervous about an investment. And that is often very true. Tesla may be an incredible company and is going to change the face of the earth in terms of how we have transportation. But the company doesn't have any earnings, and it's valued at like $700,000 or $800,000 per car it produces, whereas GM is, you know, it's about $5,000 per car it produces, and they're both producing cars. You know, kind of makes me wonder things that make you say, "Hmm."
Yeah, I think there's certain times when people are buying into a dream rather than buying into a company.
Exactly,
is what happens a lot of times.
So let me ask Barry how. And it gets, I don't know if it necessarily gets away from what we're talking. I don't believe it does, but we deal with different types of clientele here. I deal with individuals. You deal a lot with institutions and very wealthy individuals and funds and things of that nature. So you may not see this per se, but I do. And one of the things, because I read you a lot, I too am a contrarian. And I don't believe in overpaying. And right now I feel investing in the markets at these prices, you're paying full retail. Nobody likes to pay full retail. I'm wearing a sweater right now. It's a Robert Graham sweater. I got it 40% off. How? I waited till he had it on sale at the end of last season, and I got the sweater 40% off. I felt good paying 40% off. I hate paying full retail. So I've been telling people now is the time to begin building some cash. You should be selling into market tops and buying into market bottoms. You buy when they are down, you sell when they're reaching all-time highs. And you don't have to sell everything, but you start lighting up a little, and then maybe a little bit more, and if they keep rising, a little bit more, and build up cash. So when they do, when the correction does come, and it will at some point, you have the cash available to put to work by buying from everyone who is panicking, everyone who is letting their human emotion of greed and fear take over. In this case, it would be fear. And they are selling irrationally. You can be patiently buying from them. And I get so many people who don't see the wisdom in that. They just say, why do I want to get out of the market as it keeps going up? And then they'll also say to me, where do I put cash? And I say, unfortunately, right now, cash isn't going to do anything. We're going to put it in cash. You're going to get maybe a percent or so on it. And they say, oh, I'm not going to do it. It's going to hurt my performance. And then there's others who believe in that, but there's a lot who don't. What is your thoughts on that, and how do you handle, or how do you talk to people to get them to understand, if you agree with that, that having, you know, keep your powder dry, having some money for market bottoms is a good thing or not?
That's a great question. Again, that's what Dr. Thaler was trying to help folks with, is to try to see things, you know, maybe a little more logically, and to be disciplined in their investing. You know, it's incredibly challenging right now, because, you know, business some of our business is moving from our conservative style into much more aggressive styles. And, you know, I hear that same thing that you had mentioned. Someone was telling one of our clients, well, I can get you 15% a year. And I said to the client, I said, well, if they'll put that in writing, I'll put some money in that too. Which they can't. Obviously, you can't guarantee those kinds of returns. The most important thing to go back to, you know, is the fundamentals. Is that you know, losses are much worse than gains, because if you lose 50%, it takes 100% gain just to get back to even. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that, you know, folks, and talking about time, they've gotten these gains that they've had up to this point in time, and can they, you know, afford the time it takes if things do go haywire? And then the last thing, which you've already talked about, you know, and how you put together capacity for risk, is, you know, do you really need to take that extra risk? Remember, it's always taking the least amount of risk that accomplishes your goal. If you have what you need and you don't have to, you know, get that much higher rate of return, then do not take that risk. But the one thing we're facing right now is this semi-mania that people think that it's as easy as just buying an index fund and locking it away, and you know, you make 15-20% a year from now until eternity, and that's just not the way it is.
Yeah, and that actually rings real true with, or resonates a lot with a little chat I have with my university students when I illustrate for them the advantages to beginning investing early in preparation for their own retirements. That you know, kind of gone, at least in the near term, are probably the days where you start saving for retirement when you're 45, and there's such a huge bull market for over the next 10, 15 years that you put in a small amount, and then there's these huge amounts of gains, and then you can retire. That if you're going to rely, if you're going to depend so much on the earnings in your portfolio, you're going to be reaching and stretching, exposing yourselves to a lot of risk. Whereas if you start early and you're relying long-term more so on what you've put away and not what you're relying on the market delivering to you, you turn out to not, you can sleep well at night because you're not reaching for the stars as far as return. You can stay very comfortable in very managed risk exposures. And it's all about, again, kind of that long-term perspective and the benefits of you putting your own money in and not relying just on this magical market to deliver huge returns and allow you to retire.
That's very, very true. And, you know, I've got a chart I'm looking at the last 20 years, looking at the winners, you know, and the losers each year. And in that 20-year period, you know, if you were in real estate or you were in large stocks or small stocks, you know, or internationally invested, you would have had 1 year at least when you had over a 30% decline. So that sets you back a little ways. There's only one of those real investments that did not lose money. Well, two. Cash didn't ever lose money, but bonds made money every year during that 20-year period as well. So, you know, it pays to have something in your pocket that you can rely on when things get really hairy in stocks, and stocks will have their hairy periods from time to time. And the one thing that, you know, that we've done study after study, and it shows that if you add a blend of bonds to your stocks, you do not give up a lot of upside, but you give up a lot of downside. And that helps me sleep really well at night.
And do you feel even in these low interest rate environments that holds true?
It does hold true. Again, you know, I much prefer investing in stocks because I know the potential. And when I am not in stocks, I do not want to lose that money. And bonds are the place to be. And let me just address one issue that's kind of like an elephant in the room we haven't even talked about, and that's tax cuts. A lot of this rally has been based on the fact that, you know, we're talking about tax cuts. And I have some disturbing news. The research that we've conducted, the period before the tax cuts, Kennedy, Reagan, and Bush, the 1 year before, the markets averaged almost 12% in gain prior to the signing of the tax cut. The 1 year following the signing, the market did 1.9%. So it's something called buying the rumor and selling the news. But you know what did well in that year after? Were bonds. So we could, even though interest rates are low, you're not going to make much in terms of income. We could see bonds actually do fairly well. Rates could come down a bit. I know it sounds surprising, but it's the contrary thing. No one believes that bonds are a good holding right now. That's one of the reasons why we think you should have some in the portfolio.
Interesting. And one other thing that I want to add, because I know we're running short on time, about 4 or 5 minutes left in this segment and show until we have you on in November. I often tell people, especially those who are looking at the strong returns in their portfolio, especially their retirement portfolio, and if you are close to retirement, if you are in your 50s and listening, most of our listeners are in their 50s and 60s, if you are in your 50s, you're in what I call the transitional period of retirement. You are too old to truly ride out any significant drop in the market, but you're too young to truly get fully out of the market. Bear in mind, gains on your statement, a statement, when you get a statement in the mail and say, hey, here's what you had last quarter, here's what you had the quarter before, here's what you had the end of last week, whatever statement you're looking at, a statement is a snapshot in time of what you would have had if you sold everything. It's not what you have today, and it's not what you're going to have tomorrow. Those gains are not locked in. When there are Wall Street induced gain, as I put it, Wall Street giveth and Wall Street taketh away. And it's not yours until you sell. And that's why I personally am a big proponent of selling into market tops. I'd rather sell you something at full retail, especially if I know at some point in time, the same thing I just sold you is going to be on sale 30, 40, 50% off. I'd rather sell it to you today at full retail, wait patiently, buy it back from someone else, if not you, 30, 40, 50% off, and my return, my true return, is the difference between the two. And that is my money that I can use for something else. But when you look at money on a statement, it's not what you have. I see that all the time, Barry. People come to me and they'll say, oh, I got $500,000 in my 401k. And then I have to say, well, you and your uncle have $500,000 401k. You probably have closer to $350,000. And you have $350,000 today. I don't know what you're going to have tomorrow. It's not really yours. So I just want to warn our listeners about that. Barry and I talk all the time about investing, and Barry makes his living off of managing, professionally managing money. But I think you would agree, Barry, it's not your clients until they call you and say, hey, Barry, send me all that money. I'm going to go spend it on a trip around the world.
Truer words of I don't think have ever been spoken. You, it's not yours until you sell it, and that is one of the great things about investing is that you always have a chance to do well the next day.
Okay, well, that music, Barry, says we're at the end of another show. I want to thank you again, Barry, personally. I know we for coming on the show, and we need to chat about getting you on in November. November is also Turkey Day week, so we'll have to find out your schedule to see if you're going to be around for Turkey Day. And if not, we'll get you on a little bit before or a little bit after the Thanksgiving Day holiday. But I want to thank you for coming in again, and I'm sure Chris does.
Yeah, it's always a joy to have you on the show. We really appreciate you joining us and sharing your wisdom with our Northern Colorado listeners.
It was my pleasure. Had a lot of fun.
Okay, thanks, Barry. And to our Northern Colorado listeners, I again want to point out that we are practicing financial planners, and also we do investment management for our clients. If you ever have any questions about your investments, your portfolio, or more importantly, Social Security, retirement, para, don't hesitate to reach out and give us a call. We have our main office here in Fort Collins. We have a satellite office at I-25 and 34 in the Centura area of Loveland. And we have an office in Boulder as well, somewhere on Arapahoe. I still haven't figured out where on Arapahoe.
Well, I gotta figure it out if you want to meet us
but,
there.
But no one from Boulder has called us yet, so I suppose we have to. And I have to learn where in Boulder it is. So we are all along the Northern Front Range to meet with any people who have questions about their investments or their retirement.
Well, thanks for joining us again this week on the Retirement and IRA Show, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.